An increasing number of countries are adopting laws and regulations designed to protect the privacy of citizens by defining how data can be securely collected, stored, and used. This rise of digital sovereignty is the result of governments, organizations, and companies becoming concerned about their dependence on foreign cloud infrastructure providers. Welcome to the Security Sessions podcast, brought to you by Talis and hosted by me, Steve Prentice. In this third season of the podcast series, we'll continue to discuss the technologies, the people, and the processes behind information security and delve into topics like data security in the cloud, quantum computing, and even the psychology behind cybercrime. In this episode, we are joined by Nellie Porter, Head of Product, Google Cloud Confidential Computing, and Todd Moore, Vice President of Encryption Products at Talis. So welcome, Nellie. Welcome, Todd.
Thank you so much, Steve, for having me to this in this wonderful podcast.
Thanks, Steve. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, it's great to see you and hear you both. So let's just get started. It seems that every day we're hearing stories in the news about growing concerns that focus on data and its use and its access by companies and countries and governments. So let's start, first of all, with some definitions. You know, we have data sovereignty, operational sovereignty, and software sovereignty. So how are they related and how do they differ? Nellie, what's the difference?
I think they all the layers of sovereignty, and we defining them sometimes maybe not very naturally for protecting data, something that we're familiar with and been familiar for quite some time. Operational sovereignty, when not only data is protected, but who is operate this environment is actually trustworthy. And the final software sovereignty is the ability for you, for this independent entity to operate completely independent from software provider, from, again, services provider. And it's being necessary, I think, in different situation of this particular digital sovereignty story. Todd?
No, yeah, I think you nailed it, Nellie. I mean, from our perspective, digital sovereignty, there's a lot of different definitions out there from my perspective. It's really about having that ability to control your own digital destiny, if you will, when it comes to data and software and operations. It's funny, from a sovereignty perspective, it's kind of a loaded term. I asked my family recently, because I knew we were doing this podcast, Nellie, what does sovereignty mean to you? And it's weird, you know, outside the technical realm, when people hear the word sovereignty, they think of kingdom, ruling, you know, all those types of things. And I think that fits into what we do, right? We don't build kingdoms, but what we want to do is give people control to manage things within their own physical space, within their own worlds. And that does include digital items like software.
And are you referring to, you know, people on an individual level, or are you looking more sort of in a corporate level or state level?
I think in my examples, it's more, again, enterprises, corporates, governments, again, everybody that actually have to provide or consume those environments, not consumers. But you're absolutely right. Consumers is also trying to get their heads around what definitions and what we're talking about, because a lot of our customers have end users as their customers. So this all interconnected world of privacy, security, and operational independence and control, to add transparency to this wonderful set of principles, it's all what very close to consumers, enterprises, and government.
Nellie, just to add to that, I like the word that you used there, the transparency word. I think that is a key part of this concept of sovereignty. It's really organizations, whether it's Google or it's a social media application or whatever it might be, giving transparency to it could be individuals, companies, enterprises, as you said, about how their data is being used and what organizations are doing to help those folks protect that data. And sometimes it's through compliance and regulations, but it doesn't have to be. It's really, I like that word transparency, really showing someone, you know, that a company cares about what's happening with the data and giving that visibility back to that individual or that person or that organization.
And honestly, Todd, we've both been in the world of encryption and data protection for so many years. And without transparency, there is no security around this data protection, because again, the whole principles that we always operate, you need to not only trust us, but verify. And to be able to verify the principles that we are going with, transparency is absolute mandatory requirement.
Now, has this increased in pace or severity in the last few years? I mean, we're seeing so many other areas of technology seemingly rise an exponential curve of intensity. So are you seeing that this is becoming an even more pressing issue or an even more endangered issue? Is there a similar kind of rise that we're seeing, or is this just a progression from the years that since you first started?
In my view, it was always there, but it's definitely intensified in the last 3, 5, 7 years. And I think it's also based on more increasing understanding of privacy, or some concept of privacy as a human right, something that we demand and we expect from our government, enterprises, cloud providers, companies. And it's actually interesting for me to see as a trend, as the demand and again, focus on privacy from all parties, as a result, transparency and all other things is increasing. It's very interesting that from some side, it felt, especially in consumer side and social media side, that the demand for privacy is actually decreasing, and people sharing very freely so many information online without consequences that it's coming with. So it's kind of very interesting for me to see these both trends coalesce and coming together. But as more people sharing, I think the more they're trusting, as more respectful and accountable we, again, vendors and providers of these services have to be to treat this information, even when some of our users don't think about consequences of oversharing.
Good feedback about how sovereignty and the awareness of sovereignty has grown. I know there is the compliance, the regulations and the laws that are help driving some of that awareness. But I agree with you, it's always been around, it's always been an issue. You want to maintain some level of ownness of your data when it leaves your organization, but there's also a risk. And I think what you just hit on there was, it's a personal risk. And some social media applications, you'll accept more risk on the personal data you put out there, where with company data, you can't accept as much risk because of, different laws or just, you're protecting your customers. So I do think there's a continuum there. Sovereignty has always been a piece. It has come more to the forefront, though, because, again, of those laws and regulations. But also, I think there's more of an awareness as well, too. I think we hear more in the press now where different applications, I'm sorry to pick on social media applications, but maybe it's the automotive bill industry, pick another industry, where there's more high-level data breaches or there's exfiltration of personal data, which really puts the highlight back on the company itself about how are you protecting my data and making sure that it was being protected in the right way. And when you bring sovereignty into the play, part of that protection, and you mentioned encryption. Now, Lane, I love encryption, as you know. That's what I do every day. But part of encryption is a way to protect data and keep it within your ownership, but also in the confines of a particular, perhaps, physical region of the world or within a particular company. So
absolutely. And to add, it's very interesting. You probably said that the amount of data breaches is increasing enormously. I actually watching Talos site, you have really interesting way to collect information. I'm continuously for many years a big interested in data. But what is also astonishing in my mind that right now that smaller breaches, when people leak in, 10,000, 100,000 of social security numbers or your passwords, is becoming norm. It's like people looking for something completely bombardic. It's like when you're talking about millions of these particular individuals or companies. So the level of sophistication of our adversaries are growing, and the level of our protection of customer and user privacy is continue to evolve. And you're absolutely right, encryption, and we both love encryption because we spend so much time together on that, is the way how we can help customers, is the kind of the base and the best tool to provide protection and limited access and everything that it needs. And it's so important for sovereignty as a principle and the fundamental piece that we can use for data sovereignty in particular.
Let's just dig into that just a little bit more, because what you're really touching on there is the human side of this, which is a great in theory. I mean, obviously, you are both intense practitioners of this particular thing, but there's so many challenges that we have with organizations where end users just don't want to get into the whole encryption thing. You know, even something as simple as just simple password management. So we have a challenge, I think, right on the ground floor when we're looking at encryption and data protection and data sovereignty with the end users, the human beings, either not being willing to participate or perhaps not even finding the time to do it. You know, organizations supporting this from a cultural standpoint, giving people a chance to learn how to be more safe with their data. Have you observed any positive developments in organizations from, a management strategy perspective, enabling their teams to practice this correctly?
Now, if it's okay, I'll take this one first, because I think that Google Cloud, you guys do this very well in terms of what you're talking about, Steve. I think that we talked about sovereignty always being there, but if you go in the years past, it was a lot of organizations, cloud service providers would say, you, the consumer, it's your job to protect your information. It's your job to put those controls in place, like encryption. And you're right, encryption is math, but it's a difficult thing that needs to be implemented and managed over time. And you know, companies like Talos can help you do those types of things, but it does take some work and there's some effort there. What I've seen happen over the last several years, and Google's been leading this, is really putting templates in place and giving options and opportunities for Google customers to really be able to take advantage of security that's native into an application or infrastructure like Google, but also gives you the templates and the options to do best practices, right? I think that's the important thing that your organizations are looking for. They're looking for what's the best way for me to secure my information. And if there's a template I can use, we can help protect that information and not do all the silly things that might happen or the silly misconfigurations that might happen that your data might get lost. So a lot of different opportunities working with Google to allow you to do that. And I also see more of a trend of folks being willing to opt out of things versus opt in. So when it comes to security, too often folks are said, okay, you need to do security, but you need to opt into it. You need to do something. And people find that hard to do, to check that box to opt in. I think a lot of organizations, and again, I think Google does a good job at this, is the security is already built there. And I mean, if you really want to be silly and turn it off, well, that's your own fault. But most people don't. So I think companies are taking the stand that they have to provide a secure platform, a basis at first, and then others can build on top of it. So I hope that made sense. Nelly, I don't know if you want to add anything on there, but that's kind of a view.
I think it's very important topic, and it's very important topic and close topic to my heart. And the reason why, when Steve mentioned, as I heard, that humans need to enable encryption, I started to smile, because I think they should not. And they should not even hear the word encryption. And it's exactly what, again, we're trying to make. And Google, I do believe, pioneering this approach, that usability and security is not something that you have to choose. It has to go both to add performance and scale. For example, when we created confidential computing and announced it to the world, we specifically picked the three principles. Customers should not do anything. They lift and shift the environments to this confidential vault, and it works. There is no encryption. There is no discussion about how complicated the whole entire silicon and CPUs and memory controllers, whatever. It doesn't matter. People can simply check box or opt out and get what they need with full encryption of the whole entire environment. So it's absolutely paramount to us to make these things built in or incredibly easy to use. And Steve, you bring in second example, and I love this example because in my previous life, I worked on authentication and two-factor authentication was a very interesting topic. Why people don't use it? We proved to them that second factor is important. Multi-factor, is more factor is better, all of that. And I think there's a difference, Steve, between encryption that we're talking with Todd and two-factor auth, because two-factor auth is complicated. You as user need to have second device, somebody needs to send you code, your text doesn't come, you need to figure out to send another code. It's all mess. Imagine that you don't have to do it. And for example, in some companies actually integrated this higher security guarantee and protection for authentication, like Apple with their iPhones. You're looking in your camera with your face, and somehow you authenticate it, but it's not password-based. It's actually two-factor auth. They're done so beautifully that you don't need to think about that. It's the way how we make security useful. It's the way how we make encryption paramount. And it's what we're working with Todd and again Talas on to make it all built in. It's what we're talking about. And even templates, Todd, can I slightly disagree with you? It's fantastic, but it still work. I need to follow your guidance. I need to follow your things. I need to modify whatever I do. And until we security experts and security professionals will not say, okay, don't. Take the things as it runs in your environment and bring it to the cloud. No changes needed. And all will be beautiful, more secure, more confidential, more integrity ensured. Then we have our customers where we should have them. Otherwise, it's continue to be, I don't want to explain to them again, wonderful ECC curves and trying to, or post-quantum crypto and trying to ensure that your family or my family will understand what we're even talking about. It's not going to happen. So usability and security is absolutely paramount for us to get this world a little more private, a little more protected, and sovereignty assured.
I think that's a terrific tagline to use, is you don't have to do anything. I think that'll be very attractive to people who just find this very intimidating or just a lot of extra work. So there's a couple of other elephants in the room that I think we should address here, and one of them is AI. I mean, everything right now, we're talking about AI in terms of everything that we're doing. So people get concerned about this, again, from a context of, you know, am I doing the right thing in terms of starting down some sort of sovereignty path for our organization? You know, what are the threats or the benefits that we can explain to people about the use of AI? Would that be an appropriate question and topic for our discussion here?
Any topic is appropriate. Todd and I would be able to take everything that you want. So threats that AI is, if I will mind, because again, and no surprise, Google is very seriously again committed and worked on AI for many, many years. So we have some experience with that. But security of AI, I think if I will bubble up from my mind, there is two big security issues. The first is integrity of your data. Is it your big, large, or even extra large models will be trained on? And because, again, the problem, the data that all of those models will be trained on have to be what you expect it to be. And this is what we called integrity assured. It means it doesn't have any malicious information that would impact the results of your training jobs. It's one of the areas that, again, actually huge amount of research went into that, how to identify the threats and data poisoning, as we called, when those AI jobs are trained. The second big thing is how to ensure after training those models provide the right privacy guarantee. And what I mean by that, first of all, it can be trained on very sensitive data first. And the result of your training, this model is actually not exposed. And again, due to IP rights or due to integrity concerns or tampering concerns, and can run in some confidential and integrity assured environment, so it can't be touched or influenced. And the third thing is ensures that the result that they spill out during surfing, during inference, is actually, again, appropriate. Appropriate and in so many layers, not only from security standpoint, again, temper assured and not modified, but also appropriate for us humans to consume. As we've seen, it has quite a few interesting challenges still with facts and everything else, but it's cut us as a story that we go. So if we think about this from security perspective, I think how to ensure confidentiality and integrity of the data, how to ensure that models is something that you understand what you run, and what and how to ensure that results of those models when they're doing not real inference is actually integrity and privacy and also human acceptable. I would say those are things that I would be worried about. Todd, what is your opinion on this space?
No, Nelly, I think you're right on again, as always. You know, the same data security principles that we've always had applies within artificial intelligence. We're not going to get away from it. We know AI and ML are here to stay. I think that, you know, the jury's out of when we're going to start really deploying those techniques in terms of building production code when it comes from a security perspective. But we do have to be very careful to make sure that we don't expose the privacy or the security of folks, as you just said, Nelly. I mean, will the AI engine be smart enough to realize what it's giving as an answer or what it's providing as a result is protecting someone's privacy or some corporate secret? I think there's still some work there to make sure that even if you do all the right thing with integrity and confidentiality, to make sure that at the end of the day, the artificial intelligence engine doesn't give away something it wasn't supposed to. So that there's still some security, probably analysis and work that needs to happen in that area. One thing that kind of is similar to the AI ML topic, Nelly, and I know that I think this is something that is dear to you, is when I think about AI ML, you talked about the training. I think what's the power of that is bringing all this disparate types of information together to create a result that could be even more powerful, right? But there could be a lot of private information bringing all those elements together. And then the result may not be something that's secret, but the inputs in it could be secret. And you know, I've seen you do presence in the past, and you always talk about the Las Vegas example, you know, what happens in Vegas stays in Vegas, that old adage, right? And so when I think about security of AI and ML, it does apply somewhat to confidential compute in the sense that you need an enclave, a machine, a place where information can come in. You can create an answer and somehow you know, you validate whether the answer is good or bad and you can send it back out. So there's still some work to do, I think, the bottom line around the security. I think we both said that when it comes to AI ML, but no doubt the technology is there to stay and it's going to keep getting better over the next several years. So excited about that going forward.
So how does the idea of digital sovereignty flow with or even conflict against the nature of the internet itself as a global web, the global nature of information?
Sure, I can take this one first. I think that you know, the global web is meant to be. We talked earlier about data sharing, the ability to share information amongst people, organizations, companies, countries, whatever. And you know, it was meant to be a freeform way for us to share. Now there's controls, there's gating, there's routers and things that go a part of that. But I think you know, when you start thinking about the actual data itself, I mean. There's data that's at rest, it's in motion, and it's in use. And as it flows throughout that web, you know, there is an ability built into the web construct to be able to look at each packet or each frame of data that's going through and place an identity around that and information around that to say that this information, what it is, where is it heading, who's it intended for. And so I think from a digital sovereignty perspective and you know, taking that term of web construct, the technical pieces are there to tie personal identities to that data, to give someone granularity to say that this should be protected. Encryption is already built into this web, this global web, whether or not people turn it on and off, that's up for them to decide. But the construct, again, is there to have encryption to protect data in different states. So I think that digital sovereignty fits okay, it fits well within the technical constructs of what is out there called the global web. But then you start getting into the issues of what do you turn on or off based on specific permissions and setup and policies. And so maybe that's more the controversial point. You know, you start restricting what the web can do and how it can be used. That's where I think that digital sovereignty might come into conflict with what the global web was originally intended for. Nelly, what do you think about this topic? Those are just some initial thoughts from myself.
I think it's very good thoughts. And actually, it's exactly why the previous conversation is very related. Because I think in the world of global web, the whole ideas were to create this not, again, limited, isolated boundaries between countries, between people, between organizations, when they can, again, fluidly and freely exchange information in whenever way, doesn't matter who, what sovereignty, again, and what citizenship of their of current presence is. And it's, I think it's where there is a conflict, I would say, because from one side, I feel that sovereignty does trying to create some boundary of, again, what is allow or disallow on different things and how we will keep data in the place. We call sometimes this data residency controls. And it means, again, there's a free flow of data might be impacted. We don't see it exactly as you said. But the good news, and it's exactly why WindSurf, that was definitely contributed to this global web creation, was so big supporter of confidential computing, for example. He actually said that it's a game changer. It's the same value it will provide to the world as invention of email, his very, again, famous quote in 2020. But what he's trying to say, I guess, that we can preserve the freeness of internet, but providing technological controls that allow us to protect this data. And then the location of the data becoming less important because the data will be accessed with right sovereign approvals. And the data can be flowing between different parties, fully encrypted, but protected and performed all executed on in confidential environments. So the work that we're doing together with end-to-end protecting encryption, and for example, this ubiquitous data encryption that Thales and Google created, it's an attempt to do exactly that. We encrypt data through the whole flow and ensure that decryption is only and only happening in this cryptographically isolated environment, and it can be re-encrypted and send it back. So all of that can be done, as you said. It's the principles and capability and technical controls that we enabling to happen. Now the question, how will influence our government and regulation body that they can trust those controls and do not create artificial boundary of data exchange and data traveling, because I worry exactly as I'm saying with Las Vegas, very soon people will realize, fantastic, we really greatly isolated, now vote. And it would be the biggest again conflict of the world. I don't think we will get there, but it's potential that we can help to ensure that we have some. So what, again, it's the same as usability versus security debate. I think we don't have to choose free web and sovereignty. We can have them both. And it's thanks to what we built or will continue building.
Fantastic. So I think we need, even though I know we could continue talking about this for a lot longer, it's always great to provide some advice. You know, what can we give as advice for security teams, for individual companies to expand upon this topic in terms of data sovereignty within themselves? You know, what should they be thinking about, meeting on, talking about to ensure that they are maintaining best practices to protect that data as we move through our times of enormous change?
And if I will start with very provocative thought here. So first things is they need to understand why not cloud. And the reason why it's not because I am, again, part of cloud infrastructure or part of Google Cloud. I think it's very important topic to discuss in all C-level executives, because I think cloud can provide higher security guarantee without so much work from security teams. So what I'm trying to say and bring to us your demands, your requirements, what cloud needs to do better to eliminate the amount of work we expect those companies to do by themselves. We're always talking about this shared responsibility. It's absolutely right. But how much work and enablement and onboarding we can help our customers to accomplish to reach their security, compliance, the privacy goals, all of the above.
I like a lot of what you just said there. For me, and when I talk to CISOs and C-level folks, it's all about ownership of where your data is. You just said it. Is it data at rest, data in motion, and data in use? Where is your data? It's all about the visibility. But it's funny how many CISOs and CIO to that point don't have visibility where their data is and where it's going. And so I think that's the first step, is really understanding, you know, where your data is at. Don't just think about it in rest, like you mentioned. Think about movement, data moving in use. You know, it all has to be protected. And I think that we at Talos, we like to tell folks, discover, protect, control. Those are the three action verbs we use. It's a tagline we use, but it's really about finding that critical data, protecting it in whatever way is important to you. It could be through multi-factor authentication. It could also be through tokenization. It could be through encryption, of course. And then there's the control, which is managing that, because you do have to manage your security. You can't just throw it over the fence and hope that, you know, someone's not going to steal a key from 10 years ago. The other point I would give, or advice I would give to the C-level, is that not all data is created equal. So we just got done talking about the data. And, you know, Nelly and I just spoke about the importance of data. But some things are more important than others. And there are some crown jewels that you really need to protect. And it comes back to that visibility, transparency thing again. But make sure that you've identified the data that really needs protected, put the appropriate controls in place. And the last thing I would say, coming back to Talos' relationship with Google, we're not just partners. We're a user, right? Now we're a consumer of Google infrastructure. And I think that Google provides a lot of the mechanisms for you to manage your data throughout its whole life cycle. And you can do that through external key management. You can do it through the ubiquitous data encryption with confidential compute, but just a lot of different mechanisms there for Talos as even a company to be able to protect our data when we work within Google environments. So a lot of things for CISOs to think about, but I think there's hopefully a few nuggets of good advice in there as well too.
Well, this is fantastic. I mean, we've now come to the end of our time here together today, and it's a deep dive with some wonderful circuitous conversations around the side, and that always makes for a marvelous learning opportunity for everybody. So I'd like to thank my guests, Nelly Porter, Head of Product, Google Cloud Confidential Computing, and Todd Moore, Vice President of Encryption Products at Talos. Thank you both for joining me here today on the podcast.
Thank you so much for having us, Steve and Todd. It was a fantastic conversation. Thank you.
Yes, thank you, Steve, for moderating the session. And Nelly, it's always a pleasure working with you, and look forward to us doing it again soon.
If you like what you hear, be sure to subscribe and tell a friend or a colleague or a client or all of them about us. We'll be back again in a couple of weeks with another episode, another discussion on topics that you need to know about to successfully carry on in the business of information security. So until then, I'm Steve Prentice. Thanks for listening.